We're going to continue now with the second part of Marcus and Narcissa Whitman, of their story. And we'll go right to this epic ride of Marcus Whitman's ride to save the Oregon Territory. On October 3rd, 1842, Marcus Whitman began this journey east with a Christian brother named A.J. Lovejoy and an Indian guide. Now, predictably, given the time of year, and they're traveling through the mountains, this little party soon hit terribly severe weather and much snow, which caused them great trouble in keeping on the trail, but they struggled on, and then they arrived at Fort Winty, and from there they took a new guide, and next they arrived at a fort on Compagra, where they then took a different guide, and they forged ahead. Then 4 or 5 days later, they hit a terrific snowstorm, a mountain storm, and that forced this little party to seek shelter in a ravine, and then they had to stay there 4 days before they could move again. Well, by now, the snow was very deep, and to make matters worse, there was a piercing wind, and so you had blowing snow, and of course, there was bitter cold. So pretty soon, they had to stop again until the weather improved somewhat. Then they started off again, but they ended up wandering around, lost in the snow-covered wilderness, and finally, the guide admitted he didn't know where they were. He couldn't tell for sure. So out of necessity, Dr. Whitman struggled back to Fort Uncompahgre alone to secure another guide. Mr. Lovejoy stayed where he was with the animals in camp. It took 7 days, but Dr. Whitman returned, and off they started again. Now, time would fail me to tell you of the dangers and the sufferings and the misery that dogged Dr. Whitman and Mr. Lovejoy as they pushed on east, finally reaching the Green River. Well, this river was 200 feet wide at that time, and unfortunately, it wasn't froze hard all the way across. Instead, the middle third of the river, that would be about 70 feet of it, was open water. So here the guide said they were going to have to turn back. It's far too dangerous to attempt a crossing. Now, keep in mind that Dr. Whitman was absolutely convinced of two closely related things. First, he must get east to save the mission work in Oregon. And secondly, he must get east to save Oregon for America and the cause of Christ from the domination of popery on account of the situation which we thoroughly considered last message. Now, here I'm going to allow the eyewitness, Mr. Lovejoy, to share what happened next at the Green River. That is, after the guide told Dr. Whitman, you must turn back, and in the process, turn the Oregon Territory over to Britain, the Hudson Bay Company, and Rome. Let's listen to what Mr. Lovejoy shares. The doctor, nothing daunted, was the first to take to the water. He mounted his horse, and the guide and myself shoved the doctor and his horse off the ice into the foaming stream. Away he went, completely underwater, horse and all. But directly came up, and after buffeting the rapid foaming current, he reached the ice on the opposite shore, a long way downstream. He leaped from his horse upon the ice and soon had his noble animal by his side. The guide and myself forced in the pack animals and followed the doctor's example, and were soon on the opposite shore, drying our frozen clothes by a comfortable fire. So on they went, braving innumerable dangers, suffering greatly from the cold, and then for a time from a great scarcity of provisions. The party was forced to eat one of their mules. The party was then forced to eat a faithful dog they had brought along. And then, of course, any kind of animal they could kill whatsoever. Now, in the process of time, they chanced to meet a man who told them of a group of mountain men which would be leaving from Bent's Fort, which lay ahead of them, for St. Louis in a few days. So Dr. Whitman determined to push on alone, on foot. The animals were too slow for him, hoping to catch the mountain men and join up with them. But he soon became very lost in the snow, and he found himself in very dire circumstances, wandering around the wilderness. And as he wandered, Mr. Lovejoy and the guide reached Bent's Fort ahead of him. Now here I want to quote from Mr. Lovejoy again. Late in the afternoon, he, that is Dr. Whitman, came in very much fatigued and desponding, saying that he knew that God had bewildered him to punish him for traveling on the Sabbath. And that was the first and the last time that Marcus Whitman ever traveled on the Lord's Day. At Bent's Fort, a Captain Grant, who didn't want Marcus Whitman to go to Washington, falsely told him that war had broken out between the Pawnees and the Cheyenne, so it was far too dangerous to go on since the party would have to travel through that country of the warring tribes. Now, at this point, Mr. Lovejoy remained at Bent Fort, but Marcus Whitman pushed on come what may. And I tell you, what came was more hardship, more food shortages, more trials, more tribulations. At one point, the Indian guide and Dr. Whitman made camp by a tributary of the Arkansas River. Well, there was no wood on that side. The wood was on the other side, the wood for a needed fire. The river was frozen over, but not thick enough for a man to walk across it, not safely. So Dr. Whitman laid down and wormed his way across the river, pushing an axe before him, cut the wood, and then came back the same way, only it was much more labor because he had to push the wood ahead of him as well. Now, finally, Marcus Whitman arrived in St. Louis. Then he went on to Cincinnati. And finally, Ithaca, New York, to the home of his old missionary friend, you'll remember from last message, Samuel Parker. Marcus told Parker, "I have come on a very important errand. We must both go to Washington at once, that is Washington, D.C., where Oregon is lost, ceded to the English." Well, Dr. Parker wouldn't go, so Dr. Whitman pushed on alone to the nation's capital, where, again quoting from Reverend Eel's history, he obtained an introduction to Daniel Webster, then Secretary of State, with whom he talked about Oregon and the saving of it to the United States. But Mr. Webster received him very coolly and told him it was too late, as far as he was concerned, for he had considered it, decided it, and turned it over to the president, who could sign Oregon away or refuse to do so. "You are too late," Webster insisted. "Oregon is already bargained away." Now, the Secretary of State, Daniel Webster, had made it publicly clear that he felt the Oregon Territory should not be settled by Americans. It wasn't prudent, it wasn't practical, so America should trade off her rights to the territory to Great Britain. And many congressmen thought it was impossible for families to immigrate to the Oregon Territory. And without families, there was no use in having possession of the region. Many thought also the territory was just too far away from the United States to hold it against other countries. Some very short-sighted legislators held that the whole territory was even worthless. For instance, Senator McDuff of South Carolina sneered, "I would not give a pinch of snuff for the whole territory. If there were an embankment of 5 feet to be removed, I would not consent to expend $5 to remove it and enable our population to go there. I thank God for his mercy in placing the Rocky Mountains there in between." Senator Sumner of Massachusetts declared, "By a presumptuous assertion of a disputed claim to a worthless territory beyond the Rocky Mountains, we have kindled anew on the hearth of our mother country the smothered fires of hostile strife." But in the providence of God, Dr. Whitman was able to meet with President John Tyler and his cabinet. During that lengthy meeting, and again I'll pick up with the reliable Reverend Eels here, his historical narrative, during that lengthy meeting, the objection was made that wagons could never be taken to Oregon and that consequently the country could never be peopled overland by immigrants, while the distance around Cape Horn was altogether too great to think of taking settlers to the country that way. In reply to this, Dr. Whitman told of the great value to the country and of his plans to lead an immigration through with their wagons the next summer. The president then said that he would wait before carrying the negotiations any further until he could hear whether Dr. Whitman should succeed, and if he should, there should be no more thought of trading off Oregon. Well, Dr. Whitman now turned his attention to meetings in New York. Then he went on to Boston, where he secured from the mission board a reversal of the decision to discontinue most missionary work in the Oregon Territory. He also used his time writing letters to newspapers concerning the Oregon Territory and his firm belief that families could immigrate there, and his plans to, in fact, lead a wagon train to Oregon in 1899. in the coming spring. A party of immigrants was formed. And since Marcus Whitman didn't want to serve as the sole leader and guide, a reliable man was hired as a train captain. Now, before leaving for the West, Dr. Whitman said goodbye to his relatives in New York State. And then, taking his 15-year-old nephew, Perrin B. Whitman, who figures large in the history of the Oregon Territory, years later, as a missionary, a teacher, and a trusted friend of the Nez Perce, as well as a trusted translator during various dealings between them and the U.S. government, with that Perrin Whitman, Dr. Whitman set off. On May 16, 1843, with Marcus Whitman at their head, about 875 people, including 111 wagons, I say 875 people, men, women, and children, families, 111 wagons, about 2,000 horses and cattle left Independence, Missouri for, from that point, the 2,000-mile trek to Oregon. Now, we only have time for just a few eyewitness accounts of the sacrifice, the tireless labor, and the courage of Marcus Whitman all along the trail to Oregon. These are actual trustworthy quotes from various named individuals of the train Dr. Whitman led west, and these are contained in the history of Reverend Eales. The first testimony: the Laramie River was so high from the melting of the snow that it could not be forded. A makeshift ferry was put together. Then it was necessary that a line be passed to the opposite shore. No one was willing to risk himself in swimming the river and carrying the line but Dr. Whitman, which he did successfully. With the line made fast around his waist, he plunged in and soon landed safe on the other shore, thus forming a complete ferry. Another testimony: those who saw him, this is Dr. Whitman, at the North Fork of the Platte River, 3 days crossing and recrossing that wide stream, swimming his horse to find the best ford, and at last heard him order the 100 or more teams and wagons to be chained together and driven in one long line to ford 2 miles of that river, swollen by spring floods, cheering the drivers, permitting not a moment's halt lest they should sink in the quicksands, will never forget the man or the deed. A third testimony: his great experience and indomitable energy were of priceless value to the migrating column. His constant advice, which we knew was based on a knowledge of the road before us, was travel, travel, travel. Nothing else will take you to the end of your journey. Nothing is wise that does not help you along. Nothing is good for you that causes a moment's delay. He saved us many prolonged and perhaps ruinous delays. It is no disparagement to others to say that to no other individual are the immigrants of 1843 so much indebted for the successful conclusion of their journey as to Dr. Whitman. Another testimony: at the crossing of the Snake River, all the teams were chained together in a long string, the strongest in the lead and the weakest in the middle. For quite a space, the water was swift and deep. As soon as the teams were in position, Dr. Whitman tied a rope around his wrist and, starting his horse into the swift stream, swam him over it. He then called for several others to do the same, and when there was enough of them to give the required force, the lead team was started into the current, and by the strength of the men and horses on the other side, they were drawn across. Let me give you one more example of selfless charity and courage by Marcus Whitman on the trail. As he guided the first wagon train of families to the Oregon Territory, it was a feat many said was impossible. I just talked about the Snake River and what they did there. There was one man, Ninevah Ford, at that Snake River crossing who made up his mind to go it alone. There's always one that's got to do something like this. Go it alone in spite of instructions from Dr. Whitman. The water began beating the man's wagon and oxen team slowly but surely downstream, getting closer and closer to a precipice and a whirlpool. At this point, Mr. Ford writes, I will pick up with what he said, Dr. Whitman saw me and rode back on his horse and threw a rope to me and told me to hitch it on my lead oxen, and then he put it in the horn of his saddle, and this way he towed me out on main land. And to mention just one of many times Dr. Whitman made use of his skills as a physician for the good of the immigrants. A wagon was taken out of the line of march with Dr. Whitman also turning aside. He remained with the family, delivering a baby and tended to the mother who was taken with a violent illness. There was much worrying among the immigrants on the train as they had left them behind. But, as one witness writes, as the sun goes down, the absent wagon rolls into camp. The bright speaking face and cheery look of the doctor who rides in advance declare without words that all is well, and both mother and child are comfortable. At Fort Hall, in what is now Idaho, Hudson Bay officials, rightly, of course, concerned that their grip on the Oregon territory was in peril, sought to divert the wagon train. Well, what they did is when Dr. Whitman was absent from the camp, these officials worked hard to convince the immigrants that they will never make it to Oregon with their wagons, that they would starve to death or lose their lives in some other way. The officials, in the absence of Dr. Whitman, urged them then to go south to California instead. Well, they were greatly disheartened, and when Dr. Whitman returned, they were in a very sad state. Some were in tears. And Dr. Whitman, at that point, delivered to them a stirring exhortation, summing up with this: "My countrymen, you have trusted me thus far. Believe me now, I will take your wagons to the Columbia River," which, of course, is in Oregon. As the train neared its destination, Dr. Whitman received a message that Reverend and Mrs. Spaulding were dangerously ill. And so, having brought the train through the worst and prepared the way for the successful traverse of the relatively short distance remaining, Dr. Whitman set off. He arranged for a faithful Indian to play the part of a guide, and he set off to the Spauldings and the successful treatment of Mr. and Mrs. Spaulding. From there, he went on to his mission station to prepare for the arrival of the immigrant train and to look after all of their needs when they arrived in mid-October, before going on west to actual locations much further west in the Willamette Valley. And so it was, as Judge William Strong declared in an address before the Oregon Pioneer Society in 1878, the arrival of the immigration of 1843 may be considered the turning point in the history of Oregon. Upon hearing of the successful arrival of the Whitman-led wagon train, President Tyler kept his promise, and he thwarted all attempts to trade away the Oregon territory. And then in his successful campaign for president in 1844, James Polk actually campaigned for U.S. ownership of that territory, which was still in joint ownership. Now, let us not forget the heroic Narcissa Whitman, who gave her blessing to this perilous journey of her husband and this long separation from him, all for Oregon, all for the gospel, all for souls, all for America. In a letter of February 7, 1843, to her parents and family, Narcissa speaks of her struggle with bad health during her husband's absence and other hardships. But then she says, "Believe me, dear friends, I am happy in making this sacrifice for Christ. It is for him we have made it, and I rejoice in it. Yea, and I will rejoice, however trying to the flesh. I see no reason to regret my husband going home without me, nor shall I if I suffer loss in all things. May we all meet in heaven. Praise your unworthy, your lonely, but your ever-loving daughter, Narcissa." In truth, the successful immigration of 1843 settled the issue. America would hold the Oregon Territory by right of immigration, because now increasing numbers of Americans would start to come out over the Oregon Trail. They saw it could be done thanks to Marcus Whitman. They saw that they could successfully traverse, families could, the Oregon Trail and come out, because that first group, made up of almost 1,000 people, 2,000 cattle and horses, families, 111 wagons, had been successfully guided out. In the Treaty of 1846, Britain finally gave up all claims to the Oregon Territory, and then in 1848, a territorial government, that is a government under the United States, was set up. A few years later, Daniel Webster, who had been, as you remember, so in favor of giving up the Oregon Territory, declared, I say that good man declared, "We are beginning somewhat to appreciate our great West and to hold in deserved regard those pioneers of civilization who opened to us its wonderful possibilities." He also said this: "It is safe to assert that our country owes it to Dr. Whitman and his associate missionaries that all the territory west of the Rocky Mountains and south as far as the Columbia River is not now owned by England and held by the Hudson Bay Company." Dr. Whitman's missionary co-laborer, the Reverend H.H. Spaulding, after speaking with many of the immigrants, Dr. Whitman shepherded west in that epic train of 1843, wrote this: "And through that great immigration, during the whole summer, the doctor was their everywhere present angel of mercy, ministering to the sick, helping the weary, encouraging the wavering, cheering the mothers, mending the wagons, setting broken bones, hunting stray oxen, climbing precipice, now in the rear, now in the center, now at the front, in the rivers looking out fords, through quicksands, in the deserts looking out water, in the dark mountains looking out passes, at noontide or midnight, as though these were his own children and these flocks were his own property. Although he asked not and expected not a dollar's reward from any source, yet he felt himself abundantly rewarded when he saw the desire of his heart accomplished, the great wagon route over the mountains established, and Oregon in a fair way to be occupied with American settlements." It is without doubt that Dr. Whitman's famous ride to Washington, D.C., was prompted by a grave concern to save the Oregon Territory for Protestant America and for the free course of the gospel and from the domination of Rome. Now, to the proof of that, which I presented in these two messages thus far, I want to add two things. After he had successfully brought to Oregon that large immigration in 1843, Dr. Whitman was still greatly concerned for Oregon until the Treaty of 1846 settled the issue once and for all. In a letter of April 8, 1845, Dr. Whitman wrote of his deep concern that the region could yet be, quote, added to the Jesuit dominions of this coast, unquote, if the issue of ownership was not settled once and for all with the territory put under the sole ownership of America. This didn't take place until a year later after he wrote that letter. It took place with the Treaty of 1846, which drew the current border between the United States of America and Canada in that region. In a letter to his mission board dated April 1847, Dr. Whitman recounted, "From the year 1835, it has ever been apparent that there was to be a choice only of two things: one, of the increase and continuation of British interests here to the easy exclusion of all other acquired rights, or the establishment of American interests by citizens in connection with the former," that is the domination of the territory by the British and the Hudson Bay Company. "In connection with the former, papacy was deeply rooting and founding herself in security. This was the reason for me to return home and try to bring those to carry the affairs of the mission stations and to settle the country who would stand on the footing of citizens and missionaries." Dr. Whitman, contrary to all the fears and predictions to his demise in attempting this great trip east and returning back with this wagon train, had returned. He had returned to his mission station, but his trials and tribulations were far from over. In truth, he had returned to Oregon to seal his testimony and his labors for the Lord Jesus Christ with his own blood. During his absence, Indians had burned down his grist mill and several hundred bushels of grain were destroyed in the fire. Remember, the Jesuit missionaries are hard at work now. Typical to his character, the doctor set about rebuilding the mill. Also, during his absence, an Indian had attempted to break into Mrs. Whitman's bedroom during the night and had only been frightened off by her cries for help. During 1844, after he returned, trouble had broken out between the Cayuse and Snake Indians as well as other tribes. Rumors of war were everywhere. In a four-day council, Dr. Whitman met with 600 Nez Perces as well as 300 Walla Wallas and Cayuse, and peace was maintained through his efforts. The Cayuse, in whose territory the Whitmans were located and on whose behalf they mostly labored, with some striking examples, continued their disruptive, troublemaking ways toward the Whitmans, but at the same time, they kept insisting they wanted the missionaries to stay among them. Dr. Whitman did stay among them, and with the help of a number of co-workers, he continued his constant labor among the Indians, that is, first gospel labor, but also medical labor, educational labor, agricultural labor, mechanical labors, the care of a good many children and co-workers, which made up the Whitman family and mission staff. Dr. Whitman was also greatly concerned that the immigrants arriving in Oregon in the coming years would have the means of grace and ministers, and as soon as possible, churches, schools, and colleges. And so this was on his mind as well, and he spoke to many about it and was already agitating for that. Mrs. Whitman wrote in a May 18, 1844 letter to a friend, "Our anxious desire is that the salt of the earth be found among them also," that is, among the Indians, "and also among any immigrants that came, and that this entire country may be seasoned with heavenly influences from above. The powers of darkness have long held undivided sway over this land, and we feel that Satan will not quietly yield his dominions to another." Among those added to the Whitman mission was a Mr. Andrew Rogers, an immigrant who came in 1845 to study for ministry work and missionary work under Marcus. Mr. Rogers wrote this, "I think Mrs. Whitman is one of the best women in the world. She has a family of 11 children, and strange to say, not one of them is her own. I can hardly tell you what kind of man the doctor is, for he is so much of an all sorts of a man, yet very kind and generous and persevering. I suppose as to taking the lead in missionary affairs, he takes the lead. The charity of the Whitmans, like their labors, seemed to know no bounds. The Whitman mission became a stop for early immigrants on the way to the rich Willamette Valley in the West. The testimony of one immigrant, a Joseph Smith, who came to Oregon in 1846, is very typical of many testimonies. I was mighty sick crossing the Blues and was so weak from eating blue mass that they had to haul me in the wagon till we got to Dr. Whitman's place on the Walla Walla River. Then Mother Whitman came and raised the wagon cover and says, 'What is the matter with you, my brother?' 'I am sick, and I don't want to be pestered much either. But my young friend, my husband, is a doctor and can probably cure your ailment. I'll go and call him.' So off she clattered, and pretty soon Doc came, and they packed me in the cabin, and soon he had me on my feet again. I ate up a whole band of cattle for him as I had to winter with him." Now, speaking of charity and labor in connection with the Whitmans, let me just take a minute to introduce to you some of the children of Marcus and Narcissa Whitman. Their family included two what were called half-breed girls, one white parent and one Indian parent, Mary Ann Bridger, the daughter of James Bridger, and also the daughter of Joseph Meek, another mountain man. Then there was a little boy who had a Spanish father and an Indian mother. The lad had been put in a hole in the ground by his mother when he was 2.5 years old because she didn't want him anymore. He was left there to die. In 1844, the 7 Sager children came. I told you about them in the first message. They were aged infant to 13. They were brought to the Whitmans and adopted by them. On August 23rd, 1847, Mrs. Whitman wrote in a letter, "Husband is wearing out fast. His heart and hands are so full all the time that his brethren feel solicitous about him. His benevolence is unbounded, and he often goes to the full extent of his ability and often beyond in doing good to the Indians and the white men. Last winter, my family averaged 20. This summer, 16. As I told you in the first message, I believe it, one winter reached a peak of 50. Now, the Treaty of 1846 had put the Oregon Territory in sole ownership of the United States of America. But things don't change quickly overnight. Certainly in those days when change was not so easy, and that territory was so very remote. Oregon was saved for America, but the British Hudson Bay Company would continue to dominate the region for some time yet during a transition period. And the Jesuits, on behalf of their master in Rome, would make full, one might say frantic use of that transitional time in one last desperate bid to drive out the Protestant missionaries and gain the region for popery. And by now, the Cayuse, in whose territory the Whitmans labored, had been seduced by by the Jesuits, a great many of them, into Rome's fold, including, according to one report, about half of their chiefs. At the time of the Whitman Massacre, for all practical purposes, the Hudson Bay Company was still the only organized rule in that region, and that company was, for the most part, the only law in the land. And it was, for the most part, with only individual exceptions, very favorable to the Jesuit priests who were intent on driving out the Protestant missionaries. I use Protestant in the good old way, speaking of true Protestants. And so the priests were bold in stirring up the Indians against the Whitmans and all of the Protestant missionaries. I say they were bold because the Hudson Bay Company still controlled the area. The Oregon Territory did not even have an organized territorial government till 1848. It was just organized then. The Whitman Massacre took place in 1847, the very year Marcus Whitman told Judge J.Q. Thornton that he believed, quote, nothing short of a speedy establishment of a territorial government would save him and his mission from falling into the hands of the murderous savages. So yes, America now owned the Oregon Territory, but right up until the Whitman Massacre, there was no real projection of American civil power and law other than a provisional government and a provisional governor. There was no organized military force to defend the Americans in the Oregon Territory. I say there was a volunteer militia, but it was spread out. They had to be called in from far-flung areas, so there was no organized military force to defend the Americans in the Oregon Territory. So the Indians who ultimately perpetrated the Whitman Massacre were no doubt not only inflamed by the Jesuits, they were also emboldened by the lack of any organized American law or military in that newly acquired American possession. But you see, Rome's window of opportunity was closing, and so they got more intense and more frantic in their efforts to drive out the missionaries. If the Protestants and the Americans then were to be driven out of Oregon, it would have to be done soon. Now, the issue here is historical accuracy. It's not bigotry. It's not hatred of the Roman Catholic people. We love their souls. We care about them. We tell them the truth. We share the true gospel with them. In some cases, there's much to respect, of course, and appreciate about certain Roman Catholic people. We don't appreciate their religion. We despise that. We despise popery. We despise the papacy. But I'm saying this isn't about bigotry or hatred. But based on a good deal of unimpeachable extant evidence, it's clear that Roman Catholic Jesuit priests played a major role in at least inflaming the Indians against the Protestant missionaries and setting the stage for the Whitman Massacre. And there's evidence, and I've seen it, hard evidence that the priests may have literally urged the Indians to murder the missionaries. All of the Protestant missionaries, though it didn't play out that way. Now let me just put forth some of much solid evidence which could be presented concerning what I just stated. Earlier I told you about the grist mill built by Marcus Whitman being burned down. Also destroyed was an amount of lumber and a large amount of grain. Elijah White, United States Indian agent west of the Rocky Mountains, reported in a letter to the Commissioner of Indian Affairs, the mill, lumber, and a great quantity of grain was burnt by Catholic Indians, instigated by the Romanists, that is the Jesuit priests, to break up the Protestant mission and prevent supplies to the oncoming immigration by Dr. Whitman. One of the most troublesome and violent Indians who did assault Marcus Whitman physically was an Indian named Tilkanik. After much trouble with that man, including being assaulted by him, Marcus wrote in a letter dated November 11, 1841, Tilkanik has for the past year been practicing the ceremonies of the papist. Dr. Whitman also wrote of an Indian called Joe Gray, at least that was his English name, who was laboring much to slander the missionaries against the Indians and stir them up. The doctor wrote that he knew, quote, Joe Gray is a Romanist and holds worship in the forms of that church among the Indians, unquote. So Joel Gray was obviously a very influential man and very dedicated to the religion of the Jesuits and working with them. He was holding religious services. The Whitman's co-laborer, Reverend Spaulding, told of a conversation he had with a trusted Walla Walla chief whom the Roman Catholic priests had spent much time trying to turn against the American missionaries. This is Spaulding speaking. He, that is the chief, said that they, the priests, had frequently told him that we, that is the Protestants, were poisoning the Indians, that the bishop told them that the Americans brought the measles into the country as well, that God had sent this disease upon them to show his displeasure with the heretics. Further, the chief said, according to Spaulding, that, quote, immediately on its being made, the statement spread through the country. It was in the mouth of every Indian, old and young. The great chief of the Black Gown, that is the bishop, tells us that the Americans brought the measles into the country, that God sent this disease among the heretics to show the Indians how he hates the Americans. Now, these charges of the priests that the missionaries were attempting to poison the Indians were heard by the missionaries from more than one source right up until the massacre. In a letter to the mission board dated September 1846, Marcus Whitman wrote, "The Jesuits are now preparing for a master onslaught among us. They have a large reinforcement of priests and nuns by sea and also look for one by land. They have a bishop for the Indians in Walla Walla, exclusively called the Bishop of Walla Walla." Now, there was another Indian Joe named Joe Lewis, who spent much time and effort spreading the lie that the missionaries were poisoning the Indians. Well, this man was also a Roman Catholic, and the evidence is that he was very close to the Roman Catholic priests. Now, he was not an Oregon Cayuse, but he was a Canadian Indian who was among the Cayuse, and he had come down from Canada in 1847 with a company of Jesuit priests. Joe Lewis then just showed up at the Whitmans, apparently in need, and of course Dr. Whitman helped him. But this Indian began, it was obvious, to stir up all sorts of trouble among the Indians, stirring them up against the missionaries, and the doctor asked him to leave. Well, Lewis left, but then he came back quite soon. This man played a very key part, not only in instigating the Whitman massacre, but in the actual murder itself. In a lecture he gave after the Whitman massacre, the godly Reverend H.H. Spaulding, Marcus Whitman's co-worker, stated of Joe Lewis that he, quote, spoke the English as his native tongue, in other words, as good as his native tongue, and was a devoted Catholic, wearing his cross and counting his beads often. He told the Indians that he was a Chinook, that the Americans had stolen him when a child. He had grown up in America, knew the Americans hated the Indians, and intended to exterminate them, would send missionaries first, and then the multitude would come and take the country. They had better kill Dr. Whitman and the missionaries, and what Americans there were. They could do it, and he would help them. Now remember, he came that very year in the company of Jesuit priests. On the 27th day of November, 1847, just 2 days before the Whitman massacre, Dr. Whitman and Reverend Spaulding had ridden together through a dark and rainy night to visit an Indian village and tend to some sick Indians. On that night, they stayed at the lodge of a very faithful and firm friend of the Whitmans and Spaulding's and Christian missionary work, an Indian chief named Istikus, who warned them, according to both Whitman and Spaulding, that, quote, Joe Lewis was making trouble, that he was telling his people, that's the people of Istikus, that the doctor and Mr. Spaulding were poisoning the Indians so as to give their country to their own people. In other words, Joe Lewis, the bead-counting, crucifix-wearing Indian who had come to Oregon with Jesuit priests in 1847, the same year that the Whitmans were massacred, was spreading the same story as the priests. That night, Reverend Spaulding testifies that he and his brother Marcus spoke long about the machinations of the Roman priests and the dangers facing the missionaries. According to Reverend Spaulding, Marcus said concerning his own personal danger, quote, in God we put our trust. If I am to fall by Catholic influence, I believe my death will do as much good for Oregon as my life can. Reverend Spaulding wrote after the massacre that Joe Lewis told the Indians that he had taken particular notice of the letters written by Dr. Whitman and myself from this country. Some of those letters called for poison by which we might sweep off the Indians and make way for the Americans. In accordance with this request, he said that several bottles had been brought over by the last immigration and was the cause of the sore sickness and frequent deaths among the Indians and would soon cause them all to die if the doctor, his wife, and myself were not removed. So it's very reasonable to speculate, at the very least, that Rome was behind this, the Jesuit priests were behind this massacre, that the Indians were, at the very least, emboldened to act on the lies and instigation and direction of the priests, of course, using also the Roman Catholic helpers among the Indians, I say. So the priests themselves preaching and telling the lie and spreading the lies and doing the urging, and then these Roman Catholic Indian helpers doing the same thing. And it's reasonable also to assume that the Indians thought the time is right also, that everything was coming together to get rid of the missionaries, and the priests thought it was the time to get rid of the missionaries. They were emboldened by the knowledge that William McBean, a Roman Catholic, was now in charge of the nearest fort, the fort nearest to the Whitman's mission. In the deposition of John Kimsey, taken under oath following the massacre, is this, and it's very similar to many such depositions we find after the massacre. On my way to this country with my family last fall, I called at Fort Walla Walla to exchange my teams and wagon for horses. There were at the fort two Roman Catholic priests. During my stay of about 2 days, Mr. McBean, in the presence of my wife, said the fathers had offered to purchase Dr. Whitman's station, but Dr. Whitman had refused to sell. I asked him who he meant by the fathers. He said the holy fathers, the Catholic priests. He said Dr. Whitman had better leave the country immediately or the Indians will kill him, for we are determined to have his station. Under oath, William Geiger Jr., a friend of Whitman's, testified Dr. Whitman went to Washington in the winter of 1842 and 43 to prevent, if possible, the loss of Oregon to the United States. And while gone, I was in charge of his station among the Cayuse Indians, who informed me on many occasions that the priests and the half-breeds were urgent that they should drive Mr. Spaulding and Dr. Whitman out of the country. I say most emphatically that the Jesuit priests in this country were the true instigators of the murder of Dr. Whitman and those with him, and the Roman Catholic Indians the principal actors. So we come now to the tragic events of November 29, 1847. Time only permits a summary. On the morning of the 29th, Dr. Whitman performed a funeral for an Indian. Very few Indians attended. That was very unusual, and the doctor wondered what it could mean. After dinner, 14-year-old Francis Sager, adopted son of the Whitman, shot an ox. Mission workers began dressing it. Other men and women of the mission station were at various places. Mrs. Saunders was in the school with the children. Mr. Marsh was grinding at the mill. Mr. Gillian was at his tailor's bench. Mr. Hall was laying a floor in the doctor's home. Mr. Sales was lying sick in the family of Mr. Canfield, who was living in the blacksmith shop. Mr. Bewley was sick in the doctor's house. 16-year-old John Sager was in the kitchen. Mr. Osborne and his family were in the Indian room. Mr. Rogers was in the garden. Others were scattered about. Dr. Whitman and his wife were in the dining room with three sick children. About 2 o'clock in the afternoon, an Indian came to the side door and asked for the doctor, who got out his medicine chest and went in the kitchen where the two Indians were waiting to see him. Tillacate, the war chief, began to talk to the doctor to keep his attention, while Tomahawk came behind him and struck him on the head with a tomahawk, stunning him, and then gave a second blow, at which time Marcus fell to the floor, alive but senseless. The signal now being given, probably by Joe Lewis, the slaughter began at all points, and it was a slaughter. The murders around the mission station began to take place, the Indians hacking the white men, even mutilating them horribly and killing them with knives and tomahawks, also making use of guns. It was, as one survivor put it, a carnival of blood. Mrs. Whitman drew her husband to a sofa and laid him on it, trying to revive him, but to no avail. Can you speak to me? She asked him. No, was his answer. Is your mind at peace? Yes, he said. Men were being killed all around the house and the other buildings. A man was shot by a window near Mrs. Whitman. Seeing Joe Lewis through the window, she said, is it you, Joe, who are doing this? At that point, either Joe Lewis or a young Indian standing beside him shot Narcissa in the chest. Being badly wounded, she staggered towards the sofa where her husband lay, and kneeling down, began to pray for her adopted children. Lord, save these little ones, she prayed, and she prayed for her mother, saying, this will kill my poor mother. Eyewitness accounts record, quote, the only expression of personal regret which she was heard to utter was sorrow that her father and mother should live to know that she had died in such a way. One of the Whitman's adopted children wrote of their mother, quote, she began to pray that God would save her children, that soon were to be orphaned, and that her dear mother would be given strength to bear the news of her death. When the violence first commenced with her husband, Mrs. Whitman had, according to eyewitness accounts, ordered the doors fastened, as the account runs, and the sick children removed upstairs. Others had already gone up, and she now was assisted to the same place where were Mr. Kimball, Mr. Rogers, Mrs. Hayes, two girls, and three children, that is, upstairs. Included in the eyewitness accounts published by Reverend Eales, we have this. When the Indians first came to the stairs, the women collected around Mrs. Whitman, who lay bleeding, saying, the Indians are coming. We are to die, but we are not prepared. What shall we do? She, dying, replied, go to Jesus and ask him. He will save you. At this point, a number of Indians filled with bloodlust swarmed into the house with war whoops. One chopped in pieces the face of the still-breathing Dr. Whitman. Others attempted to come upstairs, but they were stopped when an old gun was shown. Now there was a long talk between the Indian named Tam Suckey and Mr. Rogers and Mrs. Whitman. The Indian pledged his word that no harm would come to any of these white people. Just come down the stairs and go with them. But if they didn't come down, the house would be burned with them in it. And so they came down. Mrs. Whitman, of course, was helped down the stairs, and some other wounded as well. At this point, she saw the mutilated face of her husband just as he gave his last dying gasp. At this, she fell onto a sofa, which was lifted up and taken out the door under the direction of the Indians by Mrs. Hayes and Mr. Rogers. A company of Indians was waiting in a half circle. They shot down Mr. Rogers, and quoting from a survivor of the massacre, Mrs. Whitman was shot through the face as she lay on the settee. Every groan the sufferer made was answered with blows from clubs, as it did not kill her instantly. One Indian had her by the hair when another shot at her and missed, the ball going through the hand of him that was pulling her hair. When they thought that life was extinct, they threw her in the mud. Now all of the children were rounded up and lined up. Joe Lewis said we should shoot them. He urged, shoot them. Suddenly, by the grace of God, one of the murderers, a chief, blurted out, poor little things, how frightened they are. Let us not kill them. And so the children and the women were kept in captivity by the Indians instead, 46 of them to be exact. In total, 12 men plus two underage young men and one woman, Mrs. Whitman, were killed in the massacre, with several of the men dying in the following couple of days. A number of the murder victims were very badly mutilated in ways with children here I won't even go into detail. The two young men killed were both adopted sons of the Whitmans. John Sager, age 16, was killed at the same time as Marcus. Francis Sager, age 14, had successfully hid himself, but out of concern for his sisters, came out of hiding some hours later. At that point, one of the Indians took hold of him and said, you are a very bad boy, and shot him dead. In addition to the 14 victims who were killed outright, Helen Meek died 2 days later of wounds received, and little Hannah Sager, another Sager, age 6, died 5 days after the massacre. Several days after the killings, the women and children were made by the Indians to sew up the massacre victims in sheets and bury them in a mass shallow grave. I say made to do it. They would have wanted to do it. They were not allowed to until several days later. Now, one of the men I mentioned is killed in the massacre, as I counted them up, was actually wounded, and he escaped. I count him as being killed because he did die then as a result of the attack on the mission. Peter Hall was wounded, but he ran into some bushes carrying a gun with him. He had wrenched away from one of the Indians. He made his escape, and he showed up at Fort Walla Walla. But the record is very clear that Mr. William McBean, the Roman Catholic in charge of the fort, refused Mr. Hall entrance. Reverend Spaulding gave this account of what happened to Peter Hall as he heard it from witnesses. Four Indians attacked Mr. Hall lying on the floor in the cook room. The first gun missed fire. When Mr. Hall wrenched the gun from the Indian and they ran, giving him time to reach the brush where he lay till dark, and that night found his way to Fort Walla Walla, but was turned out, put over the Columbia River, and has never been heard from since. It is said he was immediately killed by the Indians. There were in the fort, beside the gentleman in charge, which is McBean, some 20 white men, including some 10 Catholic priests, under the immediate superintendency of Bishop Blanchett and Vicar General Brulé. These were English-speaking Jesuit priests, apart via Cape Horn and apart by the overland route. It is reported that the children of Mr. Hall, after arrival at the fort, saw the pants, cap, and sash of their father. Josiah Osborne and his wife and his children escaped the massacre. They hid under a floor in one of the buildings. They slipped away in the dark, but Mrs. Osborne was very ill, and they could only proceed very, very slowly. And the country was filled with Indians, and Mr. Osborne knew that the entire family would die of hunger and exposure at the rate they were traveling, if not by the hands of those Indians. So Mr. Osborne hid his children and his wife, other than one child, which he took with him, and reached the fort, where he was received, quote, very coldly by Mr. McBean, unquote. According to the Sager account, Mr. Osborne told McBean he would die at his gate rather than go back without aid. Well, Osborne finally did secure a Spokane Indian guide. On the way to rescue the Osborne family, the two were met by a cayuse determined to kill Mr. Osborne. The Spokane placed himself between the two and declared, if you will kill him, you will have to kill me first. And so the Osborne family was brought back to Fort Walla Walla. The cayuse fled. The family was brought back. And we'll let the head of the family, our Christian brother Josiah Osborne, tell us what happened next. We reached the fort late Sunday night. I laid my wife down and knocked at the gate. Mr. McBean came and asked, who is there? I replied. He said he could not let us in. We must go to the Umatilla, and I haven't got the time to tell you where that is. It's another place, another region. Or he would put us over the river as he had Mr. Hall. My wife replied she would rather die at the gate, that she would not leave. He finally opened and took us into a secret room and sent an allowance of food for us every day. Next day, I asked him for blankets for my sick wife to lie on. He had nothing, he said. Next day, I urged again. He had nothing to give but would sell a blanket out of the store. I told him I had lost everything and had nothing to pay, but if I should live to get to the Willamette, I would pay. Then he consented. Now, we don't have time to go into the story, amazing story of Reverend Spaulding, who was many miles from his mission and family when the killing began. The idea was to kill all the Protestant missionaries, certainly the Spauldings too. We don't have time to tell of his harrowing journey on foot to rescue his family. He was hunted by the cayuse every step of the way. We don't have time to tell of the aid and protection the Nez Perce rendered to Reverend Spaulding and his family. The cayuse had tried to, specifically Catholic cayuse, had tried to hire members of the Nez Perce tribe to assassinate the Spauldings. But the Nez Perce treated the offers of money and other incentives with contempt. And instead they rallied to protect their missionary. In fact, 50 mounted Nez Perce guarded the Spauldings all the way to Fort Walla Walla, where Mr. McBean was finally starting to sing somewhat of a different tune under pressure. Now, likewise, the time doesn't permit me to give details of the harrowing weeks the mission women and children spent in cayuse captivity before a ransom was arranged by a Peter Ogden, a man of influence, a good man. I told you there were some good men with the Hudson Bay Company. But I will tell you that early on in the captivity period, three young women captives were dragged away by Indians who wanted them for wives. One of them was young Lorinda Bewley, a very lovely young woman. She had caught the attention of a chief named Five Crows. And though she was sick and she was weak at the time of the massacre, he dragged her away with the intention of making her his wife, quote unquote. Now, during the day, Five Crows kept Lorinda in the dwelling of two Roman Catholic priests, Vicar General Francis Norbert Blanchett and Vicar General J.B.A. Brulé. Night, she was dragged back to the Indian's lodge. Now, I want to share just a few short excerpts from the testimony of Lorinda Bewley, which she gave under oath the 12th day of December, 1848. She gave it not wanting to give it, but they needed her to give it. It's not something a young woman would want to talk about, and don't worry, I won't get graphic. She gave this testimony under oath the 12th day of December, 1848, Oregon City, Oregon Territory, to a Mr. G. Walling, Justice of the Peace. The context is Five Crows arriving to take Lorinda back to his lodge. She says, quote, I was forced out of the room. That is the room in the priest's house. And let her dragged away. And from that time, I was subject to the Indian. I would return to the bishop every morning. One morning as I was wringing my hands and crying, one of the young priests spoke to me, telling me to pray to the Virgin. On another morning as I came in, the other young priest, there were other priests besides the bishops, laughingly asked me, quote, how do you like your new husband? On another occasion when Five Crows came, Lorinda said this, Bishop Blanchett spoke first and said, you had better go and be his wife. I refused. I had rather die. I arose terrified at his words and looks and commenced crying, begging him not to send me and to have pity upon a poor helpless girl. He, that is the bishop, said I must go. And he called to Joe, his servant, to take me over. And the servant came in. I fell upon my knees before the priest. Oh, do pity me. Save me. Save me. Don't give me to the Indians, but shoot me. He rose up and brushed away my hands, that is, the bishop, and said to the servant to take me over. I then sprang toward two young priests, holding out my hands, appealing, but they said nothing and moved not a hand, and the servant, half dragging, half carrying me, hurried me away. Now, thankfully, Miss Bewley and the other young women taken captive by the Indians for wives were finally ransomed. But even after the captives had been delivered to Fort Walla Walla and were awaiting boats to take them to Vancouver, there was danger that the Cayuse, very real danger, would renege on the agreement, attack at a vulnerable moment, and retake the hostages. In other words, they got great plunder out of trading them. Now they would take them back by force. There was really no way to stop them once they got out of that fort to go to the boats. In fact, as they were being taken to the boats, a large party of Cayuse appeared, mounted, painted for war. At the critical moment, in the providence of God, a band of mounted Nez Perce also appeared. That tribe, among which the gospel enjoyed much success and savor, they appeared and formed a battle line between the captives and the Cayuse and gave out a war cry. And the Cayuse retreated. They, we say, ran. And the hostages were gotten safely away. It took time to bring together a large force of volunteers to go after the Cayuse. But then the Cayuse War commenced. And I will tell you, there were very many willing volunteers, including the captain of the wagon train that had brought the Sagers out. And when the parents had died, he took them under his wing. And he was older. He was one of the first volunteers. A number of the Cayuse warriors were killed in battle. Five of the murderers were taken alive, found guilty in a trial, and hanged. Marcus and Narcissa Whitman were dead, but I say they should never be forgotten. Faithful unto death, they had received the crown of life. It's plain they laid down their lives for the sake of Christ, for the gospel, the salvation of Indian souls, also for their stand against Antichrist, his priests, and his false religion. In very truth, their battle was against, as ours is, against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this world, against spiritual wickedness in high places. And they overcame him by the blood of the Lamb, by the word of their testimony, and they loved not their lives unto the death. It's also without doubt that Marcus Whitman, with the support of his godly wife, saved this nation, three states and parts of two others, and in the saving ensured the free course of the gospel to the inhabitants thereof. In so many ways, the labor and the sacrifice of the Whitmans was not in vain, quite the contrary. They that sow in tears shall reap in joy. He that goeth forth and weepeth, bearing precious seed, shall doubtless come again with rejoicing, bringing his sheaves with him. I told you of those words of Reverend Spaulding this morning on that historic day, July 4th, 1836, when the Whitmans and the Spauldings stood on the south pass of the Rocky Mountains. Here they are again. And stand we dead upon the summit of those sky-built mountains, with the bright forms of Brainerd, of Butler, of Elliot, and Worcester, early missionaries to the Indians, on the Atlantic shores almost in sight, bending over the pearly gates of heaven to bid us Godspeed. Whitmans have been added to that company. Can we not almost see their bright forms bidding us Godspeed to go out in the world with the gospel and preach it and share it and overcome him by the blood of the Lamb and the word of our testimony, by God's grace that we love not our lives unto the death. The Whitmans and Spauldings have been added to that role of faithful saints who, though being dead, yet speak. They speak by their testimony. They speak by their service. They speak by their sacrifice. They speak by their lives, and they speak by their deaths. May God help us to honor their memory and emulate their faith. Amen.